the show.
Well, hey everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, and you know that here at Boundless, we have been celebrating National Adoption Month. November is National Adoption Month, and we celebrate it here at Focus on the Family, as well as here specifically at Boundless. And I know you read our article last week on Wait No More and what Focus is doing with the U.S. foster care system and how we are partnering with other organizations really to get kids here in the U.S. specifically adopted out of foster care and into loving homes, specifically within the church, because as I've said before here on the show, we should be able to do the math. I'm a liberal arts major, but I can still do this kind of math, and that is, why are there so many churches here in the U.S. and yet we have kids waiting for homes? We should be able to get this done. So we're doing our part here at Boundless, even though we are a show that is largely for young adult singles. And so many people, I think, look and they're like, hey, what does this have to do with me? I mean, I thought adoption is just for people that like either have a ton of money and just have all these, you know, kids that they want to take care of, or they maybe can't have children of their own, and so they want to have a baby or a child to complete their family. Well, we have news for you, and you're going to hear about it today. So I want to welcome Katie Porter to the studio. Katie, welcome.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Hey, hey. Many of you remember Katie when she was on our webcast and blazed us away with about a bunch of information on adoption and orphan care. Love her. So great to have you. And she is currently our program director for adoption and orphan care here at Focus on the Family. So she will offer some wonderful info for us as we discuss this today. Esther Fleece is back. Esther, great to have you on the show again.
Lisa, thank you for having me.
Woo-hoo. Esther works on all things millennial here at Focus on the Family. She's a special assistant to our president, Jim Daly, kind of keeping him clued in on what millennials are thinking and how millennials are going to be part of the worldwide church, I guess, and what, how we think and what we're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And why am I saying we? I'm not even a millennial.
Well, you're an adopted
one. I'm just trying to young myself up. I'm so just, you know, I'm just, I wish I were on the cusp right there, you know, maybe, but no, I'm a little bit older, but that's okay. But Esther, great to have you here. Esther, we're going to hear a little bit about her personal story as far as how this issue as a whole has touched her throughout her life and now why she's so passionate about it. And Paul Batura, welcome, Paul.
Hey, Lisa. Thank you.
Great to have you here. Paul is a writer here at Focus on the Family and used to be part of our radio team. He worked a lot with general market radio stations, now writes and blogs for Focus and does a bunch of other stuff in his in the capacity he's in now, so very exciting stuff. And also his wife used to work for me as well, so a little personal connection.
She's
there.
Still getting over that. Just,
I have everyone who used to work for me now no longer does, and we consider that to be a, you know, listen to the oracle, folks, listen. So well, I want to launch right into the topic here today, because like I said on the front end, a lot of our audience is probably like, what's this show going to have to do with me? You know, because here's adoption. Okay, I know we're supposed to be excited about it, whatever, but what does this mean for me? And I've been so impressed as I've gotten to know our efforts here at Focus more and more, really what adoption does mean for me as a single adult, and as a member of the body of Christ, especially. And Katie, why don't you just start out by giving us an idea of what you guys have going on this month, like why, what Focus is doing with adoption and orphan care, and just a little summary of Wait No More. We've known that through the article, but just kind of what we have going on this month that makes this topic relevant.
Absolutely. Well, a couple years ago, Focus started looking at what ways could we be involved in adoption and orphan care? And it specifically stemmed from Jim Daly, our president's heart. He was in foster care for a number of years, and through his experience has really just had a heart for kids who are in those same types of situations. And he said, as Focus, a ministry who focuses on families and parenting and raising kids, how can we help these kids in their current situations? And so where we've landed with that is an event called Wait No More, Finding Families for Waiting Kids. And that's probably the primary emphasis for what we do through our initiative here. We do events in cities around the country, encouraging Christians to just come and learn more about adoption from foster care. There are currently about 114,000 legal orphans in the United States. They're in foster care, but these are not permanent placements. They're just temporary homes while these kids are waiting for someone to step up and adopt them permanently. There are more kids than that in foster care, but those kids will hopefully be reunited with their birth family. But for these kids who literally have nobody at this point, they don't have any contact with their birth families because it's been determined it's not a safe situation for them. So now these kids are just waiting for a family to step up. And unfortunately, we as Americans tend to have a lot of misconceptions about foster care, what it means to adopt from foster care, who the kids are in care, and it tends to prevent us from moving forward with adoption of these kids. But as Focus, we believe strongly that no matter their age or race or gender or special challenges or whatever, these kids need a permanent family, and foster care is better than some other situations they could find themselves in, but it's certainly not the ideal. So we've done 8 events now. We've recruited just over 1,260 families to initiate this process of adoption, which we're just completely thrilled about. The Lord is opening amazing doors, and we're so excited about that. But we also do some campaigns specifically here in November to talk about the bigger picture of adoption and orphan care, because this issue, yes, is happening here in the U.S., but it's happening in every country around the world. And the current estimates are somewhere in the neighborhood of 160 million orphans in the world, which is quite a large number. It's about half the population of the United States. So if you can just imagine that number of vulnerable and at-risk kids throughout the world in such desperate situations. And so we know not every family is called to adopt, and I'll never say that you should definitely adopt, but we are all called to do something. And there's such a myriad of opportunities to get involved with that we want to make sure that folks know those opportunities and are at least aware of what God's heart is towards these kids.
Yeah, I think it's just a rocking opportunity that we have. And for any of you out there who think that Focus on the Family is still your mom's ministry, or that it doesn't apply to you, or that you don't have, you know, we don't have anything going on, or we're so 1980s, whatever, you need to check out what we have going on specifically with these initiatives, because it's huge. Now, many of us know, as young adults, 20s and 30s, mostly in this audience, we know someone who's been adopted, or we know someone who you know, came out of the foster care system. And obviously, adoption is nothing new. But I think it would help for us to step back and recognize that there are even young adults out there now who, because they were adopted and had to deal with challenges, whether with birth parents or kind of going through that process of if they were adopted as a baby or maybe later in life, whatever, there are some transitions that happen there. And I think more than that, there's even that understanding that, you know, at the heart of every child, you know, there is that need or that desire to belong and to be loved. And obviously, ultimately, that comes from the Lord. And that's why our adoption into His family is paramount. But Esther, I wanted you to just share a little bit of your story, because I think it is so indicative of how not only it reflects the heart of God to understand what it means to be part of a family and to be part of the family of God, but when a young adult now stands here and recognizes, maybe my family situation wasn't the best, and maybe whether that was through just growing up in dysfunction or whether that was outright rejection, there's a hole that is left there. And I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, often when we look at the millennial generation here at the ministry, we realize that they're a very entitled generation. And so a lot of kids that are born in Beverly Hills and mansions and, you know, with kind of what we consider the great life, the blessed life, they often feel that they deserve that. But, you know, the reverse of that is also true. And kids that come from just abandoned situations, which is my story, often feel like they deserve that as well. So I did come from a very broken home. My father left at an early age, and my mother shortly after that. And that did include both of their extended families. So the good news is that the scripture is true. And so in Psalm 68, when God says He places the lonely in families, that's what He did for me. So I was able to avoid the foster care system, which was great because my church just looked around and saw a kid in need and took me in. And so there's been several families, even to this day, that have loved me like a daughter, like a sister, and that love has changed my life, but has also shown me what God looks like. And, you know, just as the Lord adopts us when we have nothing to offer, these families took me in when I had nothing to offer. So that love has definitely changed my life. But just getting older, you know, I'm 28 now, so at the upper end of the millennial spectrum, I do realize that, you know, Thanksgiving is around the corner, Christmas is around the corner, and holidays are still hard because you still have that desire for a permanent family. And that's still something that, you know, that is hard for me this time each year. So I hope to help be a part of the solution. And I definitely, my friends know me as an advocate for children. I want to see these children placed in homes, and I want to love them well until they are and even after.
Mm-hmm. I know you and I, Katie, when we were talking, you were mentioning, you know, people that talk to you or talk to others and just say, even at the holidays, I wish I had a dysfunctional family to go home to. I mean, to have something that's completely messed up and dysfunctional is better than having, I mean, you know, in their eyes, because it's that sense of belonging and what that means.
Right. And too often we look at kids in foster care and say, well, if they'll just make it to 18, then they can get out of the foster care system and move on. Mm-hmm. Which is, you're right, they will no longer be in the foster care system, but it's certainly not a better situation. A large percentage of these kids never go to college. They barely finish high school. They end up on the streets. They're homeless. They're on the public welfare system. These are folks that we visit in jail, that we're feeding in the homeless shelters. And so we need to be aware that the permanence of a family is so important to these kids. Even if they are able to take those next steps and get a job or maybe start attending a college or university, they have nowhere to go on Thanksgiving and Christmas. The dorm shut down, so then what am I supposed to do? Mm-hmm. Or I need to sign for a school loan. Well, there's no one who's going to sign a mm-hmm. co-sign a loan for me so I can even go to mm-hmm. school. So then I'm just caught in this endless cycle. And without having a support of people around you, it's hard to get yourself out of that. Of course, there are a few exceptions, but as a general rule, these kids would long for a family that they could go back and fight with their brothers and sisters and have the tension between grandma and Aunt Martha or whatever the case may be. They just wish they had some place to go, even if it was what we'd consider that dysfunctional situation.
Yeah, that's so true. And just it's so crazy to me to think that people look at it in that way of just, well, it's just the pragmatics, you know, just keep the kids fed, get them some backpacks for school, whatever. And then when they're 18, then they can, you know, it's right. So much more than that. So,
and we as Christians recognize that because of what God has instilled in us and our desire to connect and our desire to be in communion with other people and the closeness of a family and the way, it, adoption reflects his heart of welcoming us in when, like Esther said, we were dirty and disgusting and mm-hmm. and all of our shortfalls, but he has welcomed us into that family. And that's what these kids mm-hmm. are in a position of doing. And we actually were talking with a young woman who was adopted when she was fairly young. But she made the comment that, I feel sorry for you because you don't really understand your adoption into God's kingdom because you've not been earthly adopted. And I can really understand what that means to come from that situation and be welcomed into a family and have that permanent connection now. And I'm sorry that you can't fully understand that here on this earth. And it just was an mm-hmm. interesting perspective to come at from her view.
Okay, Paul, so you are on the other end of adoption, kind of this story. You and your wife, Julie, have adopted two little boys now. And I know that, you know, you grew up in a very, in an intact home. You kind of had the, you know, all-American kind of family. I know you love your parents and are close to them and probably didn't, you know, sit there in high school or in college and say, you know, the one thing I'm going to do is make sure that I adopt two kids, you know, and right. and have that be part of my story. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to find a Norman Rockwell kind of picture, I mean, I have Norman Rockwell's hanging in our house. I mean, that's sort of my background. And so when we were married, you know, we just assumed we would have a family mm-hmm. and it would come about just naturally, and it didn't. And so, you know, we just pursued every different option. And when adoption was first presented to us, it was extremely overwhelming. It was extremely intimidating. I thought, there is no way I can handle that, because in this situation that we were first presented with, it was an open adoption. And so the birth mother would be in our son's life, his whole life, and we would have interaction. And it just was a little bit too much for a buttoned-down traditional guy to handle. Mm-hmm. Julie was a bit more easygoing about it, and she kind of carried me along. But, you know, in some ways, I feel like I'm a guy who fell into a great fortune, because it wasn't anything I did and it wasn't anything I looked for, but it just came our way. And it truly just evolved. And after the first adoption, we were, you know, interested in adding another sibling. And that too didn't come about through conventional means. We were on a waiting list to adopt a little child. We didn't say boy or girl. We were matched with a birth mom. And then upon birth, the birth mom changed her mind. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you go right back down into the bottom of the barrel and you're struggling and you think, why did this happen? And then 5 days later, the phone rings and there's a baby born to a mother who didn't know she was pregnant, which it's on, I guess there's a show on MTV to this effect, so it must be true. Mm-hmm. And, but she gave birth and she left the hospital, and then we were called and asked, are you interested and assuming the legal risk, because at this time the birth dad was at large. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we had another choice to make, and thank goodness we made the right choice. More promptings to my wife, because she said, there's a little child who needs a home. He's literally, can you imagine in the nursery, there's no one, there's nobody in this hospital who loves that child. You have a nurse taking care of him, but there's no advocate. And so we you know, jumped in, and we're on the great ride of adoption now.
Mm-hmm. Did you, on the front end of this whole journey, before you guys even knew about Riley, you know, your oldest son, did you have those moments of thinking to yourself, I don't know if I can really love kids that aren't my biological kids as much as I would my own? Did you go through that struggle?
You know, I didn't really think too much about that. I just didn't think I could, you know, to me, adoption was just for someone else. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, we're the same age. We grew up in an era where if you were adopted, you probably looked different because mm-hmm. you were from Korea mm-hmm. or maybe from China. But we didn't really know too many domestic adopted people because it was kind of kept quiet. Mm-hmm. You just didn't know it. So it just was, I never really thought about it. But, you know, the minute I held Riley in my arms, you know, it's over. I mean, mm-hmm. you've fallen in love with him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I heard Patricia Heaton say, you know, she's from Everybody Loves Raymond. She mm-hmm. said, I used to think I knew what it meant to love somebody until I had a child. Mm-hmm. It just redefines what it really means to love somebody. Hmm. And yeah. That's been our experience.
Yeah, that's neat. Esther, talk a little bit about the gift of your families, because you've had families that have, in essence, kind of taken you in. And I know you talk about your families and kind of what they've meant to you and kind of the experience that you've had in them coming around you, not only in that initial church, that church that looked and saw you, but some of the ones that now, even though they live nowhere near you, are still kind of there for support and kind of be that sense of belonging in your own life.
Absolutely. A huge part of being an advocate for children, I think, is even mentoring. And so a lot of these relationships just recognize that I was in need, not having a father in the home. There was one man that he took his kids on a birthday trip for their 21st birthday. And he told me when I was 14 years old, I'm going to take you on a birthday trip when you turn 21. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the first men that followed through on that promise to me. And so there's just so many different families that have loved me in different ways. One of them, they have a medical background and he's a doctor and said, you know, you need to be getting shots and you need to have health insurance. And who's taking care of that for you? Can we do that for you? Another family knew that Christmas was hard. And so they would send me a Christmas package when I was at college, or another one knew that birthdays were always painful. And so they would throw a birthday party for me. And so much of it looked like a very much mentoring relationship in the beginning, because, you know, we didn't know what expectations were like and they didn't know everything I needed, but they responded. And all of those families are still in my life. If I ever get married, you know, I'll probably have at least 10 men walk me down the aisle because God has shown his goodness to me through several families. Hmm. So
that's really cool. Now, Katie, do you see, you know, as you're talking to families, because I think one of the unique things about Wait No More is how families, when they go to one of those events, can actually start the process of adoption that day. And I think that's something that's so intentional and amazing. We're all about intentionality here at Boundless. so to be able to transfer that into, you know, parents being able to get it done and be able to have that perspective shift. I want you to talk a little bit about that perspective shift. In fact, I mentioned this in the e-newsletter last week for Boundless, but really, I think it's just huge in the church today to see what we're called to do biblically and how that translates into that intentionality of bringing kids into the home.
Absolutely. It's one of those neat things that it's hard for me to kind of gauge the worldwide perspective on this, because I'm so enveloped in the adoption and orphan care community that maybe it seems bigger than it really is. But we've really seen this increase in churches, particularly here in the U.S., really taking seriously these commands. And if you read scripture over and over and over and over again, God is very clear that he seeks justice for the widow and the fatherless, and that we as Christians are called to defend the cause of the fatherless and speak up for those who can't speak for themselves. And James says that true religion is to care for orphans and widows. And those are verses that we've all read, but for some reason they don't always resonate. And it's been exciting to see this move of the Lord throughout the country saying, have you read what I wrote? I meant that. And I don't, you know, as you read through it, none of them say, adopt these children Everyone's called to adopt these children. It says, we're all called to do something, to speak up for those who can't speak for themselves, to defend the cause of the fatherless. And so as we look at that, it's been neat to see these churches saying, this is really an important thing, and it really is based in God's heart towards us. And God designed adoption. John Piper has this phenomenal video. It's about 5 minutes, called Adoption is Greater Than the Universe. And he takes it from Ephesians 1 and says that God outlined adoption before he even created the world, because he knew what would happen when he did it. He knew there would be a fall, and he knew there would need to be a way to redeem a fallen people to himself. So from the very beginning, I mean, we always think of adoption as plan B, as something that I'll look at. Maybe it's even plan D, E, or F, or somewhere farther down the line, but it's never, you know, an option A, whereas God says, this is plan A for how I'm going to redeem these lost people to myself. And the church is really waking up to that issue. In Russell Moore's book called Adopted for Life, which is a phenomenal read, and I can promote it because I didn't write it, he said, adoption on the one hand is gospel. In this, adoption tells us who we are as children of the Father. Adoption as gospel tells us about our identity, our inheritance, and our mission as sons of God. Adoption is also defined as mission. In this, adoption tells us our purpose in this age as the people of Christ. Missional adoption spurs us to join Christ in advocating for the helpless and the abandoned. And again, he's not saying every family is called to adopt, but it really is this culture that's been changing within our churches that sees adoption as part of this Great Commission and as part of our work as Christ's ambassadors here on the earth, and showing that love in a very real and tangible way to these kids. And Christ has called us to lay down our lives, and that's exactly what's happening with these families, especially families who are taking some very challenging older teens from foster care. I mean, these are some difficult situations these kids have been through, and some of them I don't even want to speak about because it's just horrendous. But for a family to say, it's not really about my needs, it's not really about what I want, it's not about us completing our perfect little family and making sure that all our kids have straight A's and play in the band and are sports all-stars. It's about saying, how can the Lord use our family to really meet the needs of this child and ultimately bring this healing through Christ that they've never known? And so seeing that change and that shift has been amazing.
And you know, Lisa, I was at church this last weekend, and the message was on God's desire for you and how as God's people, he desires you. And I was one of the ones that went up and had prayer for my pastor after, because I said, how can I believe that God desires me? I was never desired as a kid. Nobody stuck around for me. Nobody fought for me. Nobody showed me what love was. And so how am I supposed to believe that God desires me and loves me unconditionally? And you know, the afternoon talking to some of my families, they can be the ones that do advocate for me and do say, Esther, we chose you and we love you. But for these millions of kids out there, how are they going to know that God pursues them with a fierce, unconditional love if we just leave them on the streets or in the foster care system or in orphanages? Scripture doesn't talk about orphanages being God's design. Family is God's design. And so I am equally as excited as Katie is to see the church really responding, to see families like Paul and his family responding, because less kids are going to be questioning the goodness of God.
You know, and picking up, Lisa, what you talk about intentionality, and then Katie's comments about, you know, just being sensitive to what is needed. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have besetting sins, and everybody struggles. The risk, though, when you are so intentional about something, is that I think you try and plan things out too much. And that, you know, every family, when they come together, has this vision of what their family's to look like. And so, I would, you know, when this idea is presented to a church body, it probably ruffles some feathers because, I don't want five kids. You know, we only want two. And in this age, it's the great fallacy, of course, is that we can control anything. Mm-hmm. We can't control anything. And so for us, you know, for our family, we thought we had this perfect thing with this birth mom who changed her mind. We almost lost our opportunity for our second son because of my stubbornness. We got this phone call and the legal risks were great. The birth dad was not found. And that very day we were trying to make a decision, I got a phone call from another friend who said that a colleague here at Focus had died that night. And he was only 41 years old. Mm-hmm. And it was like that phone call, you know, was just finally, it was like the Lord had hit me with a 2x4 to say, don't you see, you can't control anything. There are no guarantees mm-hmm. in life about anything. And so I think that the great fear of any adoptive couple is that you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what kind of child you're going to get. You don't know the temperament. You don't know the, you know, the medical history maybe. That's daunting. But if it's of the Lord, what a wonderful thing. I mean, you can't go wrong. And I think to lay down this idea that I control things, that I can plan out my life, that is a turning point. And I think once you're willing and able to come to that point, you will be amazed at what the Lord will do for you and will bring to your family.
Yeah. We talk about that so often here on the show, even in the context of marriage. You know, what can you know on the front end? You can know that that person's a believer, that they're following the Lord, you know, chasing after the Lord with all their heart and stuff. But beyond that, you know, marriage is meant to sanctify you. And, you know, people that have these crazy megalomaniac lists and they think that they're going to, you know, basically satisfy all these requirements. I mean, they realize pretty quickly you got to chuck that out. And certainly after marriage, you know, those of Paul is married, you can attest that, wow, there are a lot of things that, you know, that crop up or things that you find out about the person, both good and bad, that ultimately will shape who you are as a couple. And I do want to, just as we wrap up, tackle a couple of things quickly. And those are, you know, some of those unexpected things, because there are considerations you have to make. And I know, Paul, you were talking a little bit before the show of your second son now, you know, having being, I think, part Hispanic, right? And so that maybe wasn't so Norman Rockwell for you. You're like, okay, well, you know, we can adopt and we can have our family and we can have an adoptive family, but we still want it to, you know, look this way or whatever.
Well, sure. Our first son said to us at one point, well, we're going to adopt a blue-eyed boy. And we said, well, we don't know that. And he said, well, we're all blue-eyed, blonde hair kind of thing. And it was an opportunity for them to say, well, God makes all kinds of people. And sure, that was hard. You know, it's embarrassing for me to say that, honestly, because, you know, you're a progressive person. You think you are. You really want, I wanted a family that looked like us, because I didn't want to call attention to ourselves. I just wanted to blend in with everybody. And when this opportunity came, and then I thought, well, of course, we have to, this is of the Lord. Looking back now, it's completely, I'm ashamed, honestly, to say that I would even have put up, because, you know, you get a list when you go to an adoption agency, what conditions, what race, what will you accept? And it's like a menu. I mean, it's really kind of hard to stomach. What will you accept? You know, and it's almost offensive because you realize when you step back to say, well, the Lord is in, these are lives. Now, not every family is necessarily equipped to take a special needs child. I understand that. But when it comes to, you know, our lawyer had told us, you know, some families only want blonde hair children. Some families only want boys or only want girls. And so that you get a little bit too picky. And I think the Lord will get your attention.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Katie, I wanted to get back to you, too, because you're kind of, you and I had chatted about you being in the middle of a relationship right now. And you know, it's kind of, you have the privilege of being the adoption poster child.
Right.
So apparently marrying you is going to be a package deal.
And right.
So talk to us a little bit about conversations that have taken place, you know, kind of as you're moving towards that road of, you know, what's this relationship going to look like?
Yeah, we, you know, most couples, as they're dating, as they get closer to marriage, they do have those conversations about children. How many kids do you want? What kind of parenting styles will you have? What kind of traditions will we set up with our kids and our family? And certainly those are all appropriate and valid, but considering especially the work that I do and the passion that I have towards adoption and orphan care, it's been interesting to have conversations with Cooper, because obviously it came up fairly early, probably awkwardly so to some extent, because, again, on a day-to-day basis, these are the questions I'm answering and the things that I wrestle with and that I'm talking about. And I told him earlier, I said, this is my soapbox, so if you don't want to hear about it, then tell me and I'll stop talking for now and we can revisit it later. But it's been neat to have those conversations, and he's not at all opposed to adoption, but he was coming at it from the same perspective as I was a couple years ago. And most of us coming through college, assume I'll go to college, I'll meet somebody probably in college, we'll probably start dating, you know, maybe my sophomore year, then we'll get engaged between junior and senior year, then we'll get married the summer after senior year, and we'll start our lives together. And then we'll probably just have a family, and like Paul said, just that assumption that we'll have a family and not really thinking too much about, well, how will we have a family? And so we've just started talking about, what if we didn't build our family the quote-unquote traditional way? What if adoption was plan A? That, I mean, a lot of families are starting to choose that, which, again, is neat to see. And it's not become such a, well, if you can't have biological children, then maybe you can consider adoption. It really is, adoption is a plan A. Maybe we'll have birth kids and we'll have kids through adoption. Both are okay and valid. But, and he's saying, I'm not opposed to that. I just had never considered it. And again, most of us in this situation just haven't considered it. But I would encourage folks to start talking along that way. Again, just not saying, well, if we get married, I'm absolutely going to adopt. And I've not laid out any kind of ultimatum like that, but certainly had the conversation that this is something that's been on my heart for a while, and I want to know that there's at least not an opposition for you. And often the Lord does use one person, whether it be your spouse or a family friend or some other relative, to just plant those seeds in you so that if and when the opportunity does arise, you're open to it, and it's not this new, you know, undiscussed topic that you've just is completely foreign to you.
You know, something else, Lisa, that Katie and her team are promoting when they're out there is what we call our wrap booklets. And it's really, it's a great tool for 20 and 30 somethings that maybe aren't in that stage of life right now to adopt. And it's just practical help, how they can help families who have adopted. And I think that that's an encouraging message to a lot of the Boundless listeners too, that you don't have to wait until you're married and have it, you know, you're in that stage to have a family, but there are practical things that you can do now. There are families in your church who are adopting, and you can bring them a meal. You can go hang out with the kids for an afternoon. And what a blessing that is, because a lot of these kids also that are transitioning from foster care, they have a lot of trust issues to this day. That's something I'm still working on. Mm-hmm. And so you could be a safe person in these kids' lives. And so I love that that's another aspect of what we're promoting here, is how millennials can get involved right now with the fatherless.
Mm-hmm. There's a family that I work with who's in that similar situation. They've got three kids they adopted from foster care from an extremely difficult background. Just the struggles these kids are facing are just overwhelming, quite frankly. And the parents have been just very burdened because no one understands or is willing to try and understand the unique challenges that they're facing. And when the four-year-old and the six-year-old are still in diapers, it's, well, why in the world are they still in diapers? It's because, you know what? They have way bigger fish they're trying to fry with these kids, that there's so much more happening in their little bodies, and they're behind developmentally, and there's just other challenges that they're facing, that the least of our worries is the fact that they can't always use the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And so when their family tried to help, their family wasn't really willing to understand what those differences were. And the family was very kind of condemning and saying, well, why don't you just do this? I've raised four kids. I know how this works. This is how you should parent those kids, without taking into consideration the challenges that these kids have experienced. And so to find someone who can consistently and regularly be in their lives. And so when she lays out for me, this is their schedule. They really need to try and follow this. This is what they're allowed to eat. Their bodies honestly can't handle these types of foods. This is what they need to do. Okay, I will follow your schedule. I will only give them what you tell me to provide. I will only interact with them in the ways that you've determined are appropriate, because you're the parent and I want to honor that. And so for her to find someone who can consistently do that is a huge blessing for them, especially as Christmas is coming and they can take an afternoon and go Christmas shopping, whereas normally they've not been able to do that. And so again, like Esther said, for young adults who have, we'd argue that we have busy lives, and certainly I feel that I do too. But compared to raising three or four children, you know, you've got a little margin in there, I'd like to say. So find some time and be that consistent support help for those families, because it really does make a world of difference.
Good. Also, just plant a seed. If someone's listening who is, you know, this sounds great and sounds wonderful and ideal perhaps, but, you know, you're overwhelmed at the idea of paying for it, because that's a practical thing. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that's the number one thing I get, the number one objection when I get, maybe it's just because I'm a guy and I run into other dads or dads who want to be dads. Mm-hmm. Oh, I could never afford that. Do not let money stand in your way of pursuing this. Mm-hmm. You know, Katie can speak to this more than me. There are tons of programs out there. There is the adoption tax credit of over $13,000. Mm-hmm. That is literally money in your pocket that you can apply from the federal government to the cost of your adoption. Never let that stop. I mean, would you rather have a brand new car or a child for that for the rest of it? I mean, that's what it comes down to. People get overwhelmed at the number, even, $20,000. How much is a new car? $25,000? But we don't think anything of making a monthly payment towards that. Mm-hmm. There are credit unions who do low interest loans. There are people who are happy to contribute if you let your need be known. Just don't let money, take money off the table.
Yeah. I had a friend who asked me, what would you recommend for a family on a budget? And I said, first of all, I would not. I would step back and say, God, is this something you're calling us to pursue? Right. And if so, then the money's not an issue. Mm-hmm. You know, like adoption from foster care is virtually free, maybe a couple $100s. Like Paul said, some of the other types do range between $15,000 and $40,000, depending on the country you're adopting from, the number of children you're adopting. But all of those factors, there's grants, interest-free or low-interest loans. There's family and community members who want to help in some way. There's all kinds of ways. The finances are the least of your worries. And some folks have even likened it to if your biological child had for some reason been taken and there was a ransom out for your child, what wouldn't you pay? Mm-hmm. What wouldn't you give to get your child back? And families who are adopting say, this is my child. They're in our family, whether or not they're living in our home right now, and I will do whatever it takes to get them back. You know, it says in scripture that the enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And that is exactly what's happening with these kids, that he is stealing their dreams and killing their hopes. And then it says that Christ has come to give them life to the full. And we believe that as Christ's ambassadors, we can help show that. And so you're right. The finances are not even a factor. I mean, certainly we need to plan out the reality of it. But if God is calling you to this, finances are certainly not a reason to not pursue it.
Yeah. Well, there is so much that we can do, and I think this is awesome. And just to have had all of your perspectives is huge in this. You know, I sometimes just sit and think, and in a number of different things, when I think of, you know, having lost my dad several years ago, or I think about adoption, or I think about other things going on in the world, and I'm like, God must just sit up there and, like, sometimes think we are nuts. Like, when we're just, like, we're so caught up in our own stories, you know, and we're so, like, I mean, honestly, like, how many years do we have on this earth before it's just all, like, whatever? So I just think it's amazing. I think it's great to be able to live in our stories with one another, to be able to share in this, and to be able to just have little windows open, even like, you know, are happening now, I think, in the church today worldwide, to recognize that, wow, you know, this is part of God's plan. This is part of his design. We are now a part of it, and we're called to be even more a part of it. And so that means all of y'all out there as well. So do write to us, editor@boundless.org, and let us know your thoughts. Tell us how you plan to get involved. Some of you I know are married. Some of you are in the process of adoption. And so we want to be able to walk that journey with you as well. So thank you so much, Katie, Esther, and Paul, for being part of this discussion.
Thank you. Thanks, Lisa.
Every lie I've ever spoken that left me bruised and broken. Every dream I thought would save me, just a scar the cold world gave me. Every plan I hoped would lift me, that I just let shape and shift me. Every fear that keeps me tethered to everything I've weathered. Set it on fire, set it on fire. In an ocean of flames, still nothing remains but you. Just you, set it on fire, set it on fire. Burn it down to the ground till nothing is found but you, just you.
Well, hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, I am in the studio with Reggie Hamm. Reggie, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Lisa.
Great to have you. Reggie is here for our chapel this week, or our monthly chapel, I guess I should say. Very privileged to have him. You guys probably know him without knowing him, so this is kind of exciting. Reggie is has penned more than 20 number one hits, a longtime songwriter, artist, producer, and most known probably in the general sphere of life for your single Time of My Life, which was at number one for a long, long time, David Cook having recorded it. And let's just launch into that really quickly, Reggie. Okay. You wrote that song. Your wife basically asked you to write it, asked you to enter the American Idol songwriting competition in 2008. Right. And what was your first reaction to that?
Well, she first reaction was she'd never asked me to write a song before in, you know, in 17 years of marriage. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of took me back a little bit. And the second reaction was just for a split second, I thought, well, I've been doing this for 30 years. I don't know about entering a contest now, you know, and I didn't even know how you do that. And
because you've written for Clay Cross.
Yeah, I'd written for, you know, I don't know how many people, but Clay Cross.
Including the Gaithers. I have to throw that out there because I love them. Gaither Vocal Band.
Yeah, I have a song on the Gaither Vocal Band record once, and
Love them.
And Kenny Loggins and Maxie Priest and Bob Carlisle and Mercy Me. And, you know, there's a list of people that I've written for. And so I just thought, I felt like that it was, for a split second there, I just thought, well, that's for people who are amateurs. But then I didn't have anything going on. And I had, and you mentioned the book Angels and Idols, and I go into what had happened in my life. And when I was in a very dark place and a very down place and had not had any success in a while. And I had nothing to lose, mm-hmm. basically. So I honored her request, and I had a week left before the contest deadline was up. So I gave it a shot.
Yeah, and there were 40,000 entries?
They tell me there were 40-plus thousand entries. I'm not exactly sure how many, but
okay,
over 40,000.
A lot by angst-filled teenage girls, no doubt.
I'm quite certain, yeah.
So you at least maybe rose to the top with a little bit of experience in that, so that was good. So obviously, David Cook recorded the song. It ended up being played at the Olympics.
Yeah.
Oprah referenced it when she did her Olympic show. Very cool. But you have got a backstory to this, and I want to talk about this because our theme for the show this week is actually adoption.
Mm-hmm.
It is National Adoption Month
right.
this month. We at Boundless are very passionate about adoption. In fact, because even the fact that we're mostly single in our audience, we're trying to share with one another as a community that adoption has a place for singles as well in supporting mm-hmm. families who are adoptive. In as you're sitting down, moving towards marriage, talking with your boyfriend, girlfriend, you better put it on the table whether or not you're going to be open to adopting kids and what God has, you know, in that for you. So it's a conversation that we're all having. Tell us a little bit about, because your parents, you and your wife Yolanda, are parents of two kids, and you went to China actually to get your daughter and came back from China and realized that she has actually a very rare genetic disease.
Yeah, we were handed a little girl with probably one of the rarest genetic disorders on the planet. She's missing a piece of her 15th maternal chromosome. It's called Angelman syndrome. And it's incurable, and she'll be the way she is for life. She doesn't speak. A lot of angels, they call them angels, mm-hmm. and I think with good reason. Mm-hmm. But a lot of angels don't walk. She does. She actually runs. In fact, I call her my cardio because mm-hmm. she runs all over the place. But they have seizure disorders and sleeping disorders, and she didn't sleep a full night for the first 4 years of her life. She slept a couple hours at a time and then be up for 20 hours and whatever, you know. And so devastating. It's devastating to raise an angel. It's mm-hmm. a very difficult thing to do. And it took my wife and I, you know, out of our way, out of our comfort zone. And sometimes it still does, you know. It's a real commitment, and it's a full-time thing. And we also have a son who was adopted in 2006, and he is perfect and beautiful and amazing and a rock star. And he takes us out of our comfort zone every day, too. Mm-hmm. So
exactly. Just in different ways.
That's right.
Just in different ways.
Don't jump off the couch again, you know what I mean, in those ways. Don't get up there on the mantle. You can't. No, don't do that.
Yeah,
you know, so.
Yeah. Well, and it wasn't like you needed, you know, it wasn't like you're like, Lord, can you please send some kind of trial into my life? Because definitely I need something going on. I mean, you had gone, I think it was when you had gone over to adopt Isabella, right? That you had a single that was rising on the charts?
Yeah, I had left the career being just a writer and had gotten an artist, a record deal as an artist with Universal Records, and had a pop record out. And that single was at 15 with a bullet when I was going to China, when I got on the plane to go to mm-hmm. China. And so, you know, things looked like they were great, and mm-hmm. The world was my oyster, as they say. And when I got back, the single had died and all my tour dates had canceled with all the cool rock bands. And and not only that, Reg, but you have a little girl with the world's rarest genetic disorder. So you don't have a career anymore, and you got to take care of this little girl. And so my wife and I went into a mode that we had no idea we could go into. And so it really tested our faith. It tested our stamina, our physical ability, just everything, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, because I think most, you know, most musicians, especially when they enter, you know, the mainstream, it's kind of like, I mean, it seems totally nuts that you would go on a trip and come back and they're already telling you, you know, you're just done. I mean, it's just
in three weeks.
That's totally nuts. Like most people don't. If you're an accountant, you kind of your career does not generally play
out
like that. So
if they hire you, you know, at the beginning of November.
Right.
They very rarely fire you at the end of November.
Right.
But it happens all the time.
When you're not even there to merit firing. I mean,
that's
just like nuts. Okay. So you were already having to deal with that. Then you're dealing with, you know, your daughter having a genetic disorder. And then you kind of come into this period where, okay, so you wrote the song. But you're still having to live life. You still are living life as you know it and as a family and reconciling, you know, this is kind of our normal. How are you now able to encourage families in the midst of all this, especially those in, you know, who are adoptive families? Because it's not, I mean, there's not just the challenge of we're adopting a child with special needs. I mean, we know that many adoptive families take in kids who are struggling, whether it's with attachment disorders,
right.
whether it's with, you know, anger,
yeah,
you know,
a lot of that. Yeah.
Churning around in the foster care system for years. I mean, a lot of families feel probably that they're floundering or that they're not quite sure what they got into. So how can you be a support, or how have you been?
Well, and we have been just really organically, particularly in the special needs community. We get a lot of people. Yolanda gets a lot of phone calls, and I get a lot of phone calls, and I actually refer a lot of people to her because she's a lot more comforting than I am. I can write you a song and that's about all, but she's a nurturing soul. You know, I think the main thing we tell everybody is to walk forward. And I know that sounds so trite, but sometimes that's all you can do. And I remember there were days when we were just in our darkest days, and I remember the alarm would go off and I'd been asleep maybe 3 hours. And I'd been up all night with Isabella, and now I've got to get up and get started. And I remember thinking, okay, I got to break this down into minutes. For this minute, I've got to sit upright. Let me see if I can do that. And let's start there. Now let me see if I can actually get my shoes on. Now let me see if I can get to the sink to brush my teeth. Now let me see if I... And it's just, sometimes you have to break it down just to seconds and minutes. And that's what we always encourage people is just take it, you know, in the smallest increments you can. Don't try to bite it all off and chew it all, you know, all on it at the same time. It's take today and just get through today and see what good can happen today. And then maybe string two or three of those days together. And then you've got some positivity going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But never give up on love, because that's all this just sounds so corny. I know people listening are going, oh man, these are just platitudes, but it really is true. And also, I guess for me, you know, it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
It might not all be good on better by Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
It might take a 6 month time period, or 8 months, or whatever, or in our case it was 5 years before we had a diagnosis of what my daughter had. We didn't know she had Angelman syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So there were five dark years of not knowing and just trying to figure things out. And, you know, it didn't reveal itself over a week or mm-hmm. over a month or over a year. It took 5 years, and sometimes it might take longer than 5 years.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean you can't have some good days in between. You know, cherish the moments that that are good,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Well, and I think that's so good, because I think we're so often, and I don't know where it comes from, because it's certainly not from Scripture. You know, we preach at ourselves that if we just do the right things, then things are going to fall into place. And if we just do XYZ, if we plug in this formula, then God is going to reward us, or then, you know, life is going to go more smoothly. And if we just make sure we don't mess up, then, but you know what? I mean, life's not like that.
Yeah. And I would probably debate someone who would argue that Jesus said that
mm-hmm.
To anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that God has promised that life will be beautiful
mm-hmm.
and that life is a gift and that life is here for a reason, and that yes, we should all be here, and we're all fellow strugglers in this beautiful life.
Mm-hmm.
But in the midst of beauty is going to be up and down, and some of it's going to be rain, and some of it's going to be sunshine. And it's not, if it's all sunshine all the time, there's no texture,
right?
You know, and I tell writers this, young writers, if you go to a movie and the first act, everything's great, and the second act, everything's great, and the third act, everything's great, that's the worst movie mm-hmm. you've ever seen in your life.
Because mm-hmm.
there's no conflict, and there's no texture, and there's no up and down to it. And so while we don't long for the bad times, Sometimes they're necessary to teach us things mm-hmm. and get us to places we need to go.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Well, you recorded Time of My Life yourself, and it is on your album, Set It on Fire. And I know you described it as saying you were just, you had to just describe yourself in the moment as to what, you know, what you were going through then and what it means to live in that moment and what God has given you or what God has taken away for that moment in time. I think that is awesome. Also on the album is a song called Orphan's Lullaby, which is very appropriate as we head into Christmas especially. Tell us a little bit about just the inspiration behind that particular song.
Well, I don't think you can walk into an orphanage anywhere in the world and not be changed. And I was... You know, when we went to China, I did walk through. It wasn't Isabella's orphanage. It was a different orphanage. But I walked through and, you know, I just came out a wreck. You know, I couldn't stop crying. And the weight of how many unwanted children are out there really fell on me. Mm-hmm. And so I can't, to be honest with you, can't remember when I wrote the song or even, and this often happens with me. Sometimes I don't even remember the process. But it's a feeling, and it's something that I was thinking about, and you know, I just wanted to write a story, maybe from the orphan's perspective. But in this story, this kid, I see him as a very hopeful child, and instead of lamenting his situation, he prays for all the kids around the world every night, and I think that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah. So. I remember you saying in the book, and Reggie alluded to it earlier, it's called Angels and Idols, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of a Would-Be Pop Star. I remember you describing just the humanity in China and just the sheer volume of people. And I mean, when you are up against people that closely, you know, that close, you you see really that picture of, you know, not only I think of community, but really of the needs that are out there. And like you said, it was only magnified being in an orphanage itself. Yeah. The book, I definitely encourage you all to check it out and definitely get more info on Reggie at Reggie Hamm. That is with one G, reggiehamm.com. Make sure you check out the album. Again, it is Set It on Fire, and the book is Angels and Idols. I'm really looking forward to hearing you in our chapel,
oh,
Reggie.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to that. Doing it. Yeah.
And definitely, we're always excited. I mean, because Focus, like I said, is so passionate about adoption and orphan care and really turning around the dialogue to say it's not about how is this child going to complete me? What is this going to mean for my family? How is this going to fill a void in my life? But what can I do for this child? And what is God called me to do biblically, as well as, you know, a member of the church and a member of Christ's community in the world. So I think it's huge. A great example from you and from Yolanda, and really, really excited to have you.
Well,
so thanks
you.
So much for joining us.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
I've been waiting for my dreams to turn into something I could believe in, and looking for that magic rainbow on the horizon. I couldn't see it until I let go, gave in to love, and watched all the bitterness burn. Now I'm coming alive, body and soul, and feeling my world start to turn. And I'll taste every moment and live it out loud. I know this is the time, this is the time to be more than a name or a face of the crowd. I know this is the time, this is the time of my life.
Hey everyone, we are opening up this week's inbox, and I have one of our counselors who you know because he's been on the show before, Danny Huerta. Hey, Danny.
Huerta.
Yes. Welcome.
Hi, Lisa.
Great
Thank
to have you.
You
here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, very apropos here that you're answering this question for us because you are Hispanic.
I'm a Mexicano. That's right.
Yes. Okay. That is good. And we know, you know, I randomly throw down people's races on this show. So that's good.
Yes. My wife's very white and American.
I celebrate diversity as well. I'm Swedish and Norwegian. So both brands of Scandinavian there. So it gets a little bit dicey in the family sometimes.
Yes, but, I bet.
All right. Well, we're going to help this girl out. This is a fascinating question. I can't wait to hear what you say. She says, I'm dating a Hispanic guy.
I really like him, but my relatives do not. They're concerned because he's Hispanic and has a bunch of cultural differences from us, and they talk negatively about him to me. My mom isn't sure interracial dating is biblical, and I disagree. How can I respect my mom while still disagreeing with her on this? And if I'm called to marry this guy, will our families ever be able to get along?
You know, I would say that this this particular lady needs to, as she talks to her mom, first affirm the fact that this is pretty anxiety-provoking for her, and there's a set of belief systems that the family already has. And so being gentle with those, it doesn't mean that they're right, but they're a reality within the family. So affirming and saying, Mom, I understand that this really isn't something you expected or wanted. However, it's going to be, this is my decision that I get to make, and I love this about this particular individual. Ultimately, our bones are the same color. The skin is different. There's a cultural richness when two cultures come together. Now, there's some good things from the Latino culture. There's some bad things from it. So you have to sort through some of that. There needs to be some stronger boundaries with the Latino families when two people get married. With American culture, same thing. There's some cultural things from American culture that aren't necessarily good, and there's some good things that can enrich the other culture. So there are two families here probably that are kind of anxious about this, a little nervous about it. Yet if you truly love this guy, you want to first respond to your mom gently and then express why you love this guy and putting race aside. Because it's really the character and the emotional connection that's important here. I would say that the rest of the family, if they're talking negatively, if I were you, I would ask for them to respect what you've chosen and be pretty firm with that. If they continue that, maybe you get some space from the family. They don't get to choose this. There's certain parts of the United States where race is a lot more sensitive than others. And so I know in California, there's a lot more interracial marrying. In New York, in Alabama, Mississippi, there is not. There's actually families that disown their kids on this. And so I know it's a very sensitive topic and one that's going to vary by state and by geographical location. Just keep in mind that one of the things mentioned here was, is dating interracially biblical? It doesn't specifically say that it's wrong. There are biblical guidelines to marrying and to make sure that there's a match in the Christian culture between the two, that you want to date someone and marry someone that's of like faith. That's going to set up some good things. But interracially, Jesus didn't seem to have any boundaries, but he wasn't dating a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. It was more of him interacting, and he treated them very similarly and looked at their hearts rather than their external appearances. And so what I would hope is a family would extend that same grace to your guy, that you look at his heart. And if there are concerns about his heart, then state those. But if it's all based on race and cultural differences, you know what? They're going to actually form their own culture within their family. And that can be really, really a powerful thing that could be a benefit to the whole family, where a new culture comes in, there's a new hybrid culture within the family that's created, and really they can make this a really good thing if they allow it to.
That's good. All right. Well, good thoughts there, and I know you've kind of walked this a little bit yourself. You know, you kind of brought a blend in, kind of your background as well, and you were talking a little bit before we started taping about, you know, recognizing, okay, what works, what doesn't, how do we make this happen, what are some boundaries you have to set, and so I think those are some good things for her to consider as well.
Probably. Yeah, you know, I would say I'll share a little bit of the personal experience. I met my wife at a church, and she, I don't particularly look like the stereotypical Hispanic, Latino male. However, it was pretty evident with the last name Huerta, right? And then our family speaking Spanish a lot, that we are Hispanic, and our culture is very, within our family, it was very much on the Latino side, and it took some adjusting between my wife and I, especially those first few years of marriage, where there were expectations placed on us from different sides of the family, and that was pretty tough because there were some hurt feelings. My parents were upset. Her parents were not understanding some things, and we had to really talk with each other as a couple. What do we want our home to be? And then present that and put the boundaries with each of our families that need to be placed. And my wife's grandpa, he was quite a guy. He was, I don't know, he was very, very blunt, and you knew his thoughts. And I remember meeting him for the first time, and he found out I was Hispanic. He was giving me Mexican jokes. He was making comments about my hair. Mm-hmm. It was pretty long at that point. Right now it's all shaved off. But he would make comments right there and was very much a racial type of guy. And I remember initially feeling uncomfortable, but then knew, okay, I know where he's coming from. I'm going to allow him to get to know me as a person without me becoming defensive. And we actually became pretty close. Hmm. We did things together. And in the past, he didn't want his granddaughter dating a Mexican, and we became friends. So maybe coaching this young man to kind of hang tough, mm-hmm. and to show who he is in his heart and not become defensive with the family. They're going through a process, maybe looking at them with compassion, mm-hmm. would be good. Important.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Danny. Sure. Thanks so much. Well, that is it for this week's show. As always, we want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org, and we will do our best to answer your question at some point on the show or beyond. Have a great, great, great Thanksgiving with your family and friends. Hopefully there won't be too much strife there. We'll have to report on this, I guess, when we return. But all that to say, happy Thanksgiving. Have a great weekend, and we will see you around next week. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.